Money FM 89.3, best of your money. Read with your money, only on Money FM 89.3.
Welcome to Read. I'm Michelle Martin, and I am so happy to be in conversation with a literary supernova. Best-selling author Michael Lewis joins us today, ladies and gentlemen. His new book is The Premonition, and it tells a real-life story of a clutch of experts who saw the pandemic coming in terms of the U.S., but it also shows how their voices never made it to the room of decision-making, and it shows with conviction a picture of the U.S. shockingly unprepared in terms of its COVID response. So The Premonition brings to life the thoughts and actions of a group of dedicated professionals who find themselves up against an indifferent White House and a deeply dysfunctional federal government. Michael Lewis, welcome to Singapore Radio and welcome to Read.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm flattered.
Can you share with us, give our listeners a sense of some context? What about the handling of the COVID pandemic in the U.S. did you want to highlight?
So what got me interested in the first place, the previous book I'd done called The Fifth Risk, was looking at essentially, well, American, but also the Trump administration's indifference to the federal government and the sort of risk management functions of the federal government, which have deteriorated badly. It was a story of me wandering around looking at sort of the critical functions like the CDC and asking what would happen if something really bad happened. Are we prepared? And my interest was piqued when it was clear that the U.S. response was just horrifically bad. Up to the point where vaccines were distributed, there was a pretty stable statistic that the United States had a little more than 4% of the world's population and 20% of the world's deaths. And this, a country that had been judged in advance of the pandemic by experts as being the best equipped to deal with a pandemic, having essentially the best material resources. And the fact that we took those from a starting point of, you know, being a team with a lot of talent, we proceeded to lose and lose and lose. That's what interested me. And the story of The Premonition is told through three characters who are kind of privileged views, both pandemic control and just more broadly disease control in the United States before the pandemic. And it takes you through their experience leading up to it and their disappointment, their crushing disappointment with how the U.S. actually responded. One of the strange facts of all this is that, you know, pandemic sort of plan strategy, as practiced by much of the sane world during this pandemic, was cooked up in the United States during the Bush administration by a group of doctors. They revived the idea of social distancing as a strategy. It had been discredited. It had thought to be have been discredited way back in 1918. And they write it into the CDC Centers for Disease Control playbook. And the Centers for Disease Control spreads these ideas around the world and they get used by other countries very effectively, but aren't really embraced by the United States. So it's a very strange story of a society that should have been very equipped to deal with the problem and then failed miserably.
So was it a lack of a playbook for dealing with pandemics, or was it a lack of a will in terms of executing that playbook?
The latter. The characters in the book sort of create the playbook way back when, and it's there. The strategies are there. It's a lack of cohesion. So, you know, at bottom, it's sort of a lack of trust in both government and each other. But one of the many things that was interesting to me to see is, you know, disease control, probably unlike Singapore, in the United States, there is not a federal system, a national system of disease control. What there are is 3,000 local public health officers who have local authority, legal authority, and pretty great powers to deal with communicable disease. But these people, these local public health officers, because they haven't had a national crisis in 100 years, their social status is apart from their legal authority, their pay, their kind of authority in the community was quite low. And it was these people who, you know, if you talk to them before the pandemic and said, like, what's going to happen if you have a real problem here? They would have told you, we aren't equipped. We've been under-resourced. We may have legal authority, but we don't have a lot of political clout. Nobody knows who we are. We're underpaid, understaffed, all the rest. They would have told you that, you know, it looks like our public health system looks like the public health system of a third world country. And this is what we're going to be leaning on in the event of the crisis. And so the answer to your question is, it wasn't that a lack of us. There was a strategy. It was in the CDC. There were resources. There was just a lack of a coordinating mechanism. And it should have been the federal government, but the Centers for Disease Control, as local public health officers would tell you, they really have not been in the business of battlefield command in communicable disease in a long time. And they drifted into becoming, through political pressure, basically an academic institution, and that wanted to kind of wait and see and have all the facts before they acted. And the problem is, as you know, with a pandemic, you can't wait that long. You need to kind of be on a war footing. And the CDC was not temperamentally equipped to play the role of wartime general. It was a sort of a peacetime leader.
So to what extent was it also about the politicization of the people in the CDC who were able to make centralized decisions? How far back in terms of administrations do things start to get so politicized that it impacts this ability to set out a centralized mandate, so to speak?
There's a very specific thing that happened during the Reagan administration, and it was the head of the CDC, who had previously been a career civil servant, and who therefore could not be just fired on a whim by a president, was turned into a presidential appointee. And this is it's a general problem with American government, that we have now 4,000 some odd jobs that the president appoints and the Senate has to confirm. And when that job became, you talk to old timers at the CDC, and they'll tell you, when that job became a presidential appointed job, the tenor of the place started to change, and for several reasons. One is, all of a sudden, the person who's being picked serves at the whim of the president and can be fired with a phone call. And so they're on a shorter leash. The second is that the kind of presidentially appointed jobs they're inherently short-term jobs, right? That the average tenure of these people who take these jobs, and they're running the federal government, is 18 months. They're running bureaucracies that have tens of thousands of employees. When a bureaucracy knows that the bosses are only going to be around for 18 months, it just behaves very differently than if it's like a difference between a homeowner and a home renter, that you've got a renter on top rather than a homeowner. And so they're managing the place not with a longer view, but with a shorter view. And the third thing is that the person who gets the job is someone who's just happens to be politically pleasing to the White House rather than someone who's picked because of their merits for the job. All of this contributed to the CDC's ineptitude and has contributed, still continues to contribute to the CDC's ineptitude. The big shift, though, that was caused by this is a kind of fear, a reflexive sort of political fear inside the CDC, that the last thing you wanted to do was anger the White House, even if it was a noble cause. And you saw the response of the CDC very early on was essentially not to look for the virus. They insisted that only a CDC's test be used in the United States, and then it turned out the CDC's test didn't work. They were very slow to test people coming back from China. It was sort of like, if we don't see it, it's not there, and which is, you know, that's a catastrophic problem, and that's how they responded. And I think there's a realization now in the country that the institution failed. What there is a solution. Like, okay, we have this institution that's inherently politicized, that's become a kind of a fearful academic enterprise. What do you do to fix it? And there aren't a lot of proposals right now. You know, you don't hear people saying, oh, we're going to change the structure of the thing. What really is what needs to happen. So we find ourselves in this curious position, and I think it's a sign of a society that's got itself in some trouble, is we clearly failed. It was clearly cost the lives of lots of Americans. There are hundreds of thousands of Americans who would be alive today if we had just an average response who were not alive. And yet we're not asking the hard questions about what we need to do to change. And we're probably in actually a worse position to deal with another pandemic now than we were 2 years ago.
For a variety. Why do you say that?
Well, first reason is that there's no general agreement in this country about what should have been done. Florida has one policy and California has another policy. And you and I can look at a map of deaths in America and we could see some pretty seemingly obvious patterns. Like, for example, the death rate in Miami, Florida is triple the death rate in San Francisco, California. The death rates in Republican red counties in California are double and triple the death rates in the blue liberal counties. Now, I don't know exactly why that is. I would guess it has something to do with, in the blue counties, people tended to comply with their public health officers, and in the red counties, they didn't. But whatever the reason, you would think we as a society would be asking, like, why? And even noticing this. But that's not what's happening. What's happening is, even in places that have quite high death rates, that clearly failed even worse than the rest of the country, there's no stock taking. There's no, oh, we screwed up. There's none of that. There's a meaningful fraction of the society, a third, maybe more, who thinks, for example, any kind of social distancing, any kind of school closures, that kind of thing, was a mistake and shouldn't have been permitted. So a new pathogen that rolls in now, rolls into an environment where some large percentage of the population is dug in its heels and said, we're not going to do anything. You know, we're not going to listen to the government at all this time. Response has been politicized. So it's a harder environment in which to sell interventions, and interventions that would save lives.
From your perspective and the perspective of the experts that you've spoken to, is there anything that the U.S. can learn in terms of what other countries have gotten right?
How about you? We can learn from you. We can learn from, I mean, people might say, well, Singapore is a poor analogy to the United States. The government's different. It's a smaller society, so on and so forth. All right. How about Australia? Why don't we go learn from Australia? But these are questions. You know, it's funny, just to back up a minute. Mm-hmm. The people and the doctors in the Bush White House who developed the pandemic strategy, they started by going back to 1918 and asking in the 1918 pandemic, what worked and what didn't? Like, why did some cities in America, for example, have much lower death rates than other cities? And very oddly, until they did it, nobody had really asked the question. And I think that astonished me, finding that out, because you would have thought that, like, back in 1918, they would have asked the question. But there's something about disease, communicable disease, pandemics, that at the end of them, the last thing people want to do is talk about them. There's kind of plague amnesia. And people are just, I mean, there have been some studies that have sort of started to kind of get at why some societies succeeded and others didn't. But they haven't penetrated the public consciousness here. People, the questions are not really even being asked. And they're natural studies to do. I mean, you know where I went, one interesting place, Sweden, Norway, and Denmark. Sweden took the view right out of the gate they were going to go for herd immunity. I don't know if you remember that. But yes. Very similar societies. Denmark and Norway have together about the same population as Sweden and half the deaths. Now, that suggests to me that the Swedish approach was maybe not the bright approach. And maybe the Swedes have figured that out. But a similar sort of thing has happened within the United States, where there are stark differences in outcomes. And people aren't even noticing the stark differences in outcomes, much less asking why. So I think lots of lessons to be learned. Nobody's in the mood to learn them. It's just nobody's in the mood to learn them. So it puts us in a complicated situation there.
Did you know there was going to be this pandemic fatigue, so to speak, and then why choose to write this story?
That's a pandemic. So it's a great question, because when I realized that there was a book I wanted to write, I knew it wasn't exactly a book about the pandemic. It was going to end in May of 2000 or June of 2020. I didn't want to write a tedious blow by blow of an event that even I wanted to forget. I was really interested in these inspiring characters that tried to prepare us for it, and experience sort of dramatized and illuminated what was broken in our system. In the same way, The Big Short picked some characters who had prescience about the financial crisis and whose peculiar experience dramatized and illuminated the weaknesses in the financial system. I didn't know if there would be a market for this story, but I did think there was an opportunity to sort of create a discussion about what the problems were through the story. And it was enough of a story that I knew it could stand alone, that, like, a movie will be made, like with The Big Short. There will be a movie. The story had a chance to kind of break through the noise or boredom with the subject, or whatever the aversion is to the subject, because at bottom, and this is going to sound very strange, it was sort of a thrilling and joyous story because the characters were so thrilling and joyous. They were so interesting. And the event is depressing. They weren't depressing. So I was kind of counting on that. And because I was so engrossed by it, I didn't pay much attention to how people were going to feel about reading about the pandemic after the pandemic.
So is that why you say this book was exhilarating to write?
It was a thrill to write. And I was aware of it when I was in the middle of it, that I had like three of the best characters I've ever had. And they were enabling me to do things with nonfiction that normally you can only do with fiction. And the stories were so compelling that this is what was thrilling about it. It was a time in my writing life where I most felt just like a conduit, like the thing was just going through me, that all I had to do was get out of the way, that I had very little in the way of work to do because the characters were so strong and their stories that they told were so powerful. That was the thrilling feeling. This is just, the material is just magical. As depressing as the material is, right? I mean, pandemic, depressing. But these people were kind of searchers for truth. They were warriors, I mean, before the pandemic, kind of warriors on the battlefield of communicable disease. They were brave, they were interesting. They had compelling stories that there were reasons why they were so interested in the subject no one was paying attention to. I mean, 3 years ago, who's talking about pandemics? Basically nobody, a handful of people, but it was a niche business and there was a reason they were in it. So it was odd. The contrast between my mood writing it and the events going on around me could not have been starker.
Can you share a little about the responses of these individuals who knew what was coming and they weren't being listened to? Were there differences and varieties in terms of how they responded?
Well, there was one thing that was very similar, and it was immense frustration, because the two doctors who had cooked up the pandemic strategy for this country and written it for the CDC way back in 2006 and 7, they'd worked in both the Bush and the Obama White Houses. They crossed party lines. They were not political people. They were doctors. They were people trying to save lives. And very original thinkers, and had real experience watching possibly pandemic pathogens around the world emerge. They were the people who, responsible people, thought, if there's a pandemic, we want them in the White House. And very oddly, at the beginning of the Trump administration, the first director of Homeland Security knew of them, had watched them way back in the Bush White House, and it called them and said, if there's a pandemic, I don't want to have to waste a day getting you badged into the White House. I want you badged in now in case there's a pandemic, because I want you two running it. That guy, his name was Tom Bossert, was fired in the middle of the Trump administration. And when a pandemic happens, there's no institutional memory of these two doctors. And so these doctors who kind of at the back of their mind sense, if the fire breaks out, we're the fire department and they're going to call us. They were sitting there watching it, waiting for the call, and they couldn't get access. They had this feeling of, I mean, they were diagnosing. You look at their emails, they were writing back and forth to each other in January of 2020. They had a bead on it. As sketchy as the information was coming out of China, they were doing really interesting what they call redneck epidemiology on Chinese hospitals, gleaning information from Chinese websites. And they got a really clear sense very early on of what the threat was and what needed to be done. So they're climbing the walls. They're calling everybody they know, but nobody's responding. So they end up shouting in the wind. Charity Dean, the local health officer who's at the center of the book, was the number two person in the California State Health Department. But in the org chart of the state of California, she's like six levels down from the governor. And her boss told her, starting in January, she was not to use the word pandemic because it was scaring people. And she had a bead on it in January of 2020. And she spent 2 months shouting and pulling her hair out and not being listened to. And so that in that sense, they had similar experiences. Once the country sort of acknowledges what's going on, to the extent it did acknowledge it, their experiences diverged because they were in just different positions. But all of them were able to see once it started and once we didn't contain it, just the price we were going to pay for having allowed our public sector, our public health infrastructure to decay to the point it had. I mean, one of the characters goes going in with offering free, you know, basically free testing to local public health officers who couldn't get a test. Mm-hmm. And the public health departments didn't have the resources even to accept the help. The last technology they had was the fax machine. You know, it would shock the government of Singapore to visit a U.S. local public health department. They'd think, what country is this? You know, how does such a rich country have such a starved public sector? But that's what we were dealing with.
Where does the book end, Michael?
Well, the book, it's funny because I didn't think of the book as being, this is going to sound strange, a story specifically about the pandemic. It was much more, I saw it much more of a, we were addressing the question of a broken system. The system happened to be the public health system. But a bigger issue that all these doctors were dealing with, which is Americans' declining ability to take care of each other and to take care of its population. It was reflected in the statistics leading up to the pandemic. We had had three straight years of a decline in American life expectancy for the first time since World War I. Something's going on in this country, and it's not a good thing. It's like the population's not being cared for, not caring for itself. And the response to the pandemic and the death rates in the pandemic were a reflection of something bigger. So the book actually ends in a graveyard with the main character, the public health officer, visiting the grave of a man whose life she had tried to save repeatedly, who the society didn't take care of. It was a homeless person. And she felt the need to say goodbye to him. And she's reflecting on essentially the inability of the society to care for this person. The book ends there for that reason. There's something deeper going on here, not just pandemic response in the United States. And the deeper thing is, it's a society that's having a hard time caring for its people. And when that happens, bad things follow.
And on that theme, when I think of a society that is having difficulty taking care of its people, the issue of gun control comes to mind. Would you ever take on that topic in a book?
You know, you just pointed out how hard it is to get people interested in a pandemic. For me, this is going to sound strange, but it's true. Characters lead me to topics. That it was these people led me to this topic. I found these characters. They were unbelievably compelling. And it just so happened that they were in the middle of the great event, one of the great events of our times. It's entirely possible that some character in the middle of the gun controversy, the gun debates here, would lead me to the subject. You're talking to someone, though, in some ways I'm very ill-suited to take on such a subject because I'm so clear in my own mind of what's right and wrong. It just seems like one side is insane. Why on earth do we have, you know, assault weapons in the hands of 18-year-olds without background checks? I mean, this is just nuts. If it was up to me, I'd get rid of all the guns. The army could have
Australia's
guns.
Australia's done it.
I mean, I just don't understand it. Handguns, any of it. It should be illegal to own a firearm, you know, maybe a shotgun for hunting kind of thing. But with careful background checks. My God, just yesterday in my little town of Berkeley, California, where we've lived for 22 years, the high school, the public high school where my middle child went, it seems to have narrowly evaded a massive school shooting. The police caught a 16-year-old with assault weapons and he was ready to go in and start shooting up the place. There's a madness here. And you're right. This is connected to what I was writing about in that we tolerate the madness because we become a little numb to the value of our citizens' lives. That's what's going on. The value placed on the guns is greater than the value placed on the lives. And that's perverse. And it's especially perverse in a land that's got at least one political party that holds itself out as celebrators of life, protectors of life. That's clearly what it's not, though. It's that there is a kind of death culture in my country that needs to be confronted. And we're confronting right now with these shootings. And God knows what happens. It feels in the aftermath of one of these shootings, it feels like something's going to happen and then nothing happens. So it's a little hard to know which way this bounces. Whether I write a book about it or not is another question. Just because it's an important subject doesn't mean it has to be a book by me.
How do you choose? Again, it's character driven, is it? I mean, when you think about markets and, you know, The Big Short and the failings of the markets that you raised in that book, I mean, are you still
it's a combination
in financial markets? And
In fact, the next book I write is probably going to be about financial markets. And it's how I choose is some very serendipitous collision, usually, between me and a character or characters I meet in a situation that seems that I want to know more about. Mm. So you asked me about like writing about guns in America. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much more I want to know about it. I mean, it seems pretty, it's not a rich and interesting subject. I know lots of people who have these assault weapons. I know what's going on in their minds. It's a kind of illness in my mind, but that's kind of where it ends in my mind. But when you say, okay, the whole of Wall Street just committed suicide in 2008 and all these firms are collapsing, I don't understand why that happened. Or you say, oh, America has 4% of the population and 20% of the deaths from COVID. Well, I don't understand why that happened. I need to explore that to explain it to myself. So when you say, ask me how I choose is a curiosity. Like, I just want to know more about it. There's something I feel I need to come to terms with and understand for myself that I don't understand.
And maybe that's why we love your books, because you bring us close to that mystery as well. Mike Lewis, thank you so much for this conversation.
Well, I'm flattered you had me. And congratulations on your own COVID response.
Thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye.
And we're out. Thanks, Michael. Bye.
Bye-bye.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download our audio app. That's AWEDIO. Available on Google Play or the App Store.